I'm Dan Dreher, and this is Colorado Matters. This year's winner of the prestigious Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion is Holmes Rostin III. He's a professor of philosophy at Colorado State University, as well as an ordained Presbyterian minister. Mr. Rostin's been called the father of environmental ethics, and he joins us today in our studio. Thank you for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me what winning this Templeton Prize means to you.
Well, I'm pleased to get the prize. Everyone is pleased to get a prize. But what it means to me is recognition for the causes for which I've been standing for several decades. And that's the great part.
One of your early articles was titled, "Is There an Ecological Ethic?" I wonder if you could tell us about your answer to that question.
Yeah. My answer to that question is yes, as you might suspect from the title. It's a more complex answer than might appear. There's an ecological ethic in the sense of humans have a good deal at stake in the condition of their environment. But the bigger answer is that humans ought to care for the natural world. We have duties toward the creation.
You wrote in that article that we have a duty to preserve the whooping crane and a duty to preserve the wolves. We have a duty to preserve endangered plants for what they are in themselves because they are a part of God's creation. That's really not the traditional Judeo-Christian view of nature, is it?
Well, it depends on how traditional you mean. I think if you go back to biblical times, to early Christianity, yes, there's a certain sense of respect for the landscape in the Hebrew Scriptures. Jesus says that the birds of the field, the flowers and birds of the field, have glories exceeding that of Solomon. But if you're thinking of Christianity in the last 400 years, since the days of Enlightenment, no. We've tended to feature dominion over nature and the centrality of humans.
That mankind is a steward of the land, but utilizes the land that mankind is a steward of.
Well, steward is a word that can go several ways. Genesis has the language of dominion. That's a rather domineering concept of stewardship. I'd almost prefer to say trustee. I think you find that in the second chapter of Genesis, where the early couple, a kind of parable of creation, are supposed to tend and keep the garden. Trustees, maybe, as well as stewards.
I'm intrigued by the idea that I think I've read about where you were out walking one time and found a rare species of either bird or plant, and probably no one had seen that before. And you were quite happy with the fact that this was out here and it had not been possibly discovered.
Well, discovered. It was a rare plant. I think you perhaps have in mind an occasion when I found a whorled pogonia. They were quite rare in the Virginia woods. They were not unknown, but no one knew they were in that region. And yes, I was prowling around off the trail where probably no one much had ever been, and came upon a whorled pogonia in bloom. And I take that to be a kind of a moment of truth, celebrating this beauty, sort of all by itself, tucked away in a secluded glade.
You've said often that you have spent your life in a lover's quarrel with science and religion. Tell us more about what you meant by that.
Well, the lover's quarrel is that I do respect both science and religion, but both science and at least the Western monotheism in which I was raised had a way of thinking of the centrality of humans. The scientist often wanted to say that nature was value-free until humans took an interest in it this way or that. Nature was sort of neutral to values. And the theologian said much of the same thing. They often thought that the purpose of nature, God gave us nature to be used as a natural resource. So I had to challenge both the scientists and the theologians to think differently, to try to think about nature as having value for what it is in itself, what I call intrinsic value.
If you just tuned in, our guest is Holmes Rosten III. The CSU professor of philosophy is considered the father of environmental ethics. He recently won the prestigious Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion. Let's talk more about this question of value. You are not arguing that nature is value-free. Is that correct?
Parts of nature may be value-free. I think if we go to the moon or Jupiter or Mars, you might say that those regions are value neutral. But I'm mainly making the claim about biology, that in the biological world, far from being value free, the biologists routinely talk about survival value. It's more a value laden, a kind of a contest of values in which each thing is defending its own kind. Species are good of their kind. And so I tend to see the biological world as a value-laden domain.
And what does that mean, value-laden?
Well, it means that in natural history, over evolutionary history, there have been generated myriads of different kinds of plants and animals, and each of them is a good thing. The biologists are inclined now to respect biodiversity. If you want to change your language and look at the Hebrew scriptures, in the beginning, God created heavens and earth, and in the first days of the creation, made the plants and animals and looked at it and said, this creation is a good thing.
You're often cited for bringing up the 23rd Psalm in terms of explaining this a little bit. Why does the 23rd Psalm resonate so much here on this point?
Well, there are various good psalms, but I'm maybe trying to think again about the 23rd Psalm. The 23rd Psalm has the picture of green pastures, but it's in the valley of the shadow of death. It has the picture of a table prepared, but in the midst of enemies. And I'm interpreting that to mean that life persists, life is provided for, life is supported in the natural world, and yet it's not without struggle. It's in the valley of the shadow of death. It's in the midst of enemies. So life generated, regenerated, I take that to be a perennial religious theme and a rich one in the Bible.
I forgot, was it lions or some other wildcat that you've seen in Africa attack a prey and stalk it in a way, and it pleased you to see that happen?
Yes, I saw three lionesses take about 40 minutes to stalk two zebras, and they got upwind of one and took it down. And I thought that was a religious experience, the way they did that. Actually, though, there's a verse in the Bible that the young lions roar, seeking their prey from God. You don't hear that preached on too much or taught in Sunday school classes, but I think that's a great Bible verse.
Maybe this is stretching the metaphor a little too thinly, but if mankind is able to take dominion over a particular piece of land and do something better with it, is that any different than the lioness overtaking the zebra and doing something with it?
Well, humans belong on the planet. I'm not saying that humans, too, ought not to, as you say, take over portions of the planet to make it their own. They should do this. But there is a difference between humans and lions. Humans are a unique species. They have culture. They have massive amounts of power. Also, they have a conscience. Humans are the only species that can sort of look over the whole Earth, that know they're on a planet. Lions can't do that. So lions don't have that kind of massive power to dominate the planet. Humans do. Humans have a conscience that goes along with this power. That's why we need an environmental ethic.
Our guest is Holmes Ralston III. He teaches philosophy at Colorado State University and recently won the prestigious Templeton Prize for progress toward research or discoveries about spiritual realities. Now, you were born in Virginia and raised in the Shenandoah Valley. What effect did that landscape have on your view of nature?
That's a great landscape. Shenandoah Valley is a beautiful place. It's inhabited traditionally by Scots Presbyterians. The Scots in the old world loved their religion and their landscape. The Scots Presbyterians I knew, my father ancestors were such, they loved that landscape and they loved the gospel. So I would say that my formative years were in a great environment.
Your dad was a fly fisherman and a minister.
Granddad, actually. He was a celebrated fly fisherman in that country. Thing about Dad was he knew the waters. He always knew which way the streams were going to flow. He was a local expert on that. He was a great gardener. He could make things grow where nobody else could.
And I'm assuming, I have this vision of you as a child, just roaming the hills and just taking in as much as you could. Is that true?
Yeah, I wandered around. In those days, you were free to go where you please, both there in Virginia in the Shenandoah Valley, and then Dad's place was a farm in Alabama, so I wandered around the bayous and swamps in central Alabama.
Were you encouraged to go into the church?
I was free to do what I wanted to do, and I did not in the beginning seek to become a minister. My college major's in physics and in mathematics. Even in those days, I loved science, and Dad welcomed that decision, but of course he was glad when I later decided to change and go to theological seminary.
You joined the philosophy department at CSU in 1968. Did teaching at a state agricultural school make it more difficult for you to be taken seriously within your field?
Well, CSU is a great school, and at CSU I think it's been a very positive environment. So I wouldn't have become what I've become without that support system. But if you want to put that on the national and international scene, yes, I think it probably did. So here was this guy teaching at a Cal College out in Colorado, and, you know, what does he have to say to the big academic guns at Harvard or Yale or to the big theologians in the UK or Europe?
How hard was it to get published?
I think I was trying to write in the margins of philosophy. In the beginning, I said rather naively, I wanted to do philosophy of nature, and people kind of chuckled at me and said, oh, you mean philosophy of science? And I said, well, yes, but I really mean philosophy of nature. And they would say, well, that went out with the days of Henry David Thoreau or Ralph Waldo Emerson. And likewise, I might say, well, I want to do theology of nature. And back at least in mid-century then, that too was out of style. So I was not writing what it was expected that young upcoming academics would write.
What was it like teaching students at CSU? I mean, it's one thing to go up against, as you say, the big guns of Harvard and Yale. What was it like interacting with the students in Fort Collins?
Well, the students were a much more receptive audience, and a lot of what I say and think has been forged over the years in the dialogue that takes place in class. I taught early on a science and religion class, which has become a permanent part of the curriculum there. I created an environmental ethics class. Students were quite responsive. I would sometimes turn away three times as many students as I could take in that class.
We're talking with Holmes Rosten III. He is the recent winner of the Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion, and he's a professor of philosophy at Colorado State University. The environmental movement adopted many of your views, particularly the concept that preserving nature is a good thing to do in and of itself. We have laws to protect endangered species, laws to protect wilderness. I wonder, how much credit do you take for those?
Well, both those acts would, of course, been passed without me, so they are going on over my head. The credit I would take would be sort of bringing philosophy into this conversation. And so from time to time when the legislators in Washington were considering passing this or that bill, they would have a study group, and I would often be in on those study groups. I was in on one on outdoor recreation. I was in on one that had to do with the renewal of the Endangered Species Act. I have often been a consultant to the U.S. Forest Service in one form or another, so I'll be a bit modest about it, but I think I have helped to form public opinion to think more philosophically about values in nature.
What is your assessment of the state of the environment in 2003?
Well, there's good news and bad news. We have cleaner air than we've had. We have clean water. We've set aside hundreds of wilderness areas, some 600. We have many, some 500, over 500 national wildlife refuges. So a lot of good things have happened. On the other hand, there's some bad news. Global warming is more of a threat than it has been before. The present administration is not cooperating in the Kyoto protocols. The present administration isn't as environmentally friendly as we could wish.
What do you say to the folks that say that the Endangered Species Act is weighted too heavily toward nature? We can't protect the spotted owl because jobs are at stake.
Well, in the case of the spotted owl, I don't think it's weighted too heavily. We have only a fraction of the old-growth forest. The jobs that might continue if we decimated the old-growth forest might take those loggers another 10 years. But you're solving the problem in the wrong place in that sense. You seldom solve a deep social problem by sacrificing the last of your wildlands.
What do you think about this? The fact that the Endangered Species Act is sort of in limbo at this point?
Well, it's in limbo because it's quite popular. Americans are proud of the Endangered Species Act. And we want it, and the legislators know their citizens want it, and so forth. On the other hand, it does threaten certain economic interests, and therefore legislators who have to answer to these economic interests are reluctant to come sort of straight out and affirm it. So it's in a kind of curious limbo. It's loved at large, and it's disliked in particulars.
As winner of the Templeton Prize, you'll receive more than $1 million. What do you plan to do with that money?
I'm going to use that sum in its entirety to endow a chair in religion and science with a focus on caring for nature. At my alma mater, Davidson College, a good school in North Carolina, not too far from Charlotte. It's kind of where I got started intellectually some half century back. And I'd like to think 50 years hence, maybe 100 years hence, young minds at that college will be stimulated like mine was.
What did the folks at Davidson say when you told them?
Well, before the big press conference in New York, I slipped by Davidson College, and I didn't tell them exactly why I was coming, but I did tell them something was brewing. And Bobby Vaught, the president, welcomed me and then fell out of his chair when I told him both that I'd won the prize and I was going to hand it over to Davidson.
Thank you very much for your time, and congratulations.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure again to be here.
Holmes Rosten III is a professor of philosophy at Colorado State University and the winner of this year's Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion.